Chapter 5, Consciousness in Michigan. In 1980, a group of students and faculty at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo held a one-day retreat exploring views from various disciplines on the subject of consciousness. The organizers had a framework around which the retreat was planned, and Vivekananda Monastery at Ganges was invited to send a speaker. It was not a large gathering, but intimate and friendly, and when it was finished, I felt the session had gone as well as could be expected. Vedanta considers its study of consciousness one of its most important contributions to human thought, and the question itself one of the most important we can raise. It is true that we do reach conclusions about it, which differ from most others. I propose in this talk to make these as clear as possible. Although it may seem to you that we are begging the question, these conclusions, as will be explained later, are evidenced by direct experience. Let us begin with what consciousness in its essence is not. That's one way to define things. It is not a ghost, a chimera, as supposed by behaviorists and others. It is not a product or byproduct of something else. This means that consciousness cannot be an epiphenomenon, as many think it to be. It is not dependent on anything else. It is not a relation. It does not belong to time. Therefore, it is ineradicable, ineluctable. It does not belong to space. Therefore, it is not finite. It is not substance, obviously, although we can speak of it that way, in contrast to form, where all change takes place. It is not an object of knowledge or experience. It is not life, which is usually characterized as reactive, complex, purposive, unpredictable. It is not mind, as that word is used by most Western thinkers and writers. It is not the field of attention of the psychoanalysts, which is only one aspect of consciousness. These points will be discussed as we go along. Then, what in the world is it, if it isn't any of those things? Nothing in the world, that is for sure. Vedanta makes the bold assertion that it cannot be a what, an object. Therefore, even to ask what is consciousness is illogical. The cosmology of this system tells us that what we are perceiving in our present state of ignorance through the mind and senses, unpurified, is the supposed combination of spirit and matter. It is termed in Sanskrit the chid-jada-granti, the knot tied between spirit or consciousness and the inert or physical matter. Now, if you think well about this, I believe you too will reach the conclusion that such a knot could never be tied, for they cannot in any way be put together. Therefore, as Vedanta conceives it, our business, or that of any spiritual aspirant, is to untie this alleged knot, to extricate, as it were, consciousness from the things which are clinging to it. We are to rescue our consciousness. Now, if this language seems self-contradictory, for we are speaking of it as an object, do not worry. The situation seems paradoxical, and contradictions crop up until the mind can begin to grasp the finer implications. Yoga tells us that we can stop all the changes which appear to be rippling the surface of consciousness. A diagram will be given now by way of illustration. But first, a word here about paradigms, formulas, and diagrams. They can be useful pedagogic devices. We attempt, by symbol and objectification, to give approximations of the situation in ways such that our unenlightened mind can have some intuitive grasp of the truth which just now seems beyond it. It is true that an entrapped consciousness can never solve its own problem. It has to see that it was never trapped. But this is not easy. The mistake made by easy forms of spiritual advice is in their failure to provide the stepping stones that we need to cross this river of ignorance and the impetus to make the leaps. This diagram is a stepping stone. In this schema, consciousness is shown as the ultimate, the universal medium in which the entire universe is suspended, so to say. This may seem an unwarranted assumption, but we should be aware that we are making assumptions about ourselves all the time. Without the body, I do not exist. Or, my mind is separate from other minds. Let a sheet of paper represent pure consciousness. This is our diagram. The large circle is you, or me, any individual. By drawing this circle, we circumscribe, as it were, that which is undivided and indivisible. Now within this circle, representing the consciousness of our full 24 hours, we go through three principal phases, each quite different from the other. The waking state, the dream state, and the state of dreamless sleep. Just as the space in each small circle is a portion of the space of the large circle, so is the consciousness attributed to the individual as a whole superimposed on the underlying universal consciousness. In other words, the large circle cuts me off from the truth, just for the sake of explaining. This means that when I suppose that in dreamless sleep I am unconscious, this cannot really be true. There was a witnessing consciousness there, observing the absence of mentation. Otherwise, how could I report on awakening? I slept happily, I slept deeply, with no dreams, and I am now refreshed. The Upanishads also argue that the reappearance after deep sleep of a dreaming and a waking world, along with a sense of one's own ego, cannot have come out of nothing. Likewise, this witness consciousness underlies our dreaming and our functioning in the waking state. We have chosen over years or lives to ignore it and come not to believe in its existence. Strange. We can regain awareness of this witness consciousness, says Vedanta, through meditation and other practices, and with persistence we can recognize it as the ultimate, the absolute, the Brahman. The sages and seers have used the words being and bliss also to indicate it. People who make these explorations are called in India Jnanis, thinkers, intellectuals, and more than that. How is a Jnani supposed to think? Before we spoke of meditation and other practices, and here are some examples of the sort of examination and discrimination employed by those who follow the path of Jnana Yoga, the knowledge or reasoning method for realizing the goal. All sense data are to be scrutinized. The senses are reckoned as five, in east as well as west, and no doubt you know how, in Western philosophy, the discrimination is made between the primary qualities of an object and the secondary ones. Here in Vedanta, we mentally eliminate not only these, but all qualities. From the object, on one level its form, on another its name. What remains when all name and form has been subtracted is the thing in itself, so familiar to us through Immanuel Kant, except that Kant failed to realize that the thing in itself is the same as me and myself, a fact that can be discovered only by personal experience. By continually separating the subject from every perception in the objective field, we are not long in discovering that our own body, sense and motor organs, even our mind, belong to the field of object, not subject. When every aspect and function of the mental operation also has been separated out, pure consciousness alone remains as subject, or better, beyond all subject-object relationship. And I am that. In our diagram above, this is what we have called the sheet of paper. In this waking state, where we try so hard to satisfy our needs and desires, somehow we come up short. The senses tire, the mind too, and we say body and mind need rest in sleep. What can we learn from the dream state? In dream, we do not know that we are dreaming, for Vedanta this defines it. Otherwise, it moves into lucid dreaming, which is another story. Not only do we not know that we are dreaming, but all judgments about our dreams are made upon waking up and from the waking state. Such is the biological fatigue theory, the Freudian wish-fulfillment explanations, and the Jungian system of symbolized message, and so on, depending upon the psychologist. The Vedantic theory, too, is enunciated by persons in the waking state, but what it says is that we dream in order to escape the ego-imposed limitations on consciousness, which the waking state imposes upon us because of our identification with the body. The latter is simply not adequate to give us the play we need to express the freedom we crave so much. Who has not, in dreams, jumped from heights without injury, traveled miles underwater, made enemies evaporate, accomplished unimagined and unbelievable feats? In short, everything we cannot do here while awake. On waking, we call dreams nonsense or hidden messages, but we did not do so at the time of the dream. So far as our awareness was concerned, the world we roamed in was real at that time, or we neglected to inquire if it was real. This is important to remember when we come to our analytic conclusions. I have a friend who told me that he was examining his dream world, and a doubt crept into his mind. Is this a dream or not? No, he said, everything here is quite reasonable, logical, it's not incongruous, it has to be no dream. Well, then he woke up, remembering what he had dreamt, and saw that it had all been most unreasonable. This was his waking judgment. One moment of lucidity had come, and the rest followed. It will be clear to you, then, that in this Vedantic study of consciousness, the philosophical and psychological significance of the dreaming and waking phases is of more importance than the content of the dreams. And now from dreamless sleep, let us turn to sleep without dreams, sushupti, the Sanskrit word for deep sleep, if, as we just said, our mind is baffled by trying to satisfy itself through the organs of the waking state, and attempts and succeeds through dreams in gaining greater scope for the ego and sense of freedom. It is also true that eventually it tires of this also. Like a bird at the close of day, weary of beating its wings, settles down toward its nest, so does our mind, according to the Upanishads, let go of its dream world, and the ego lapses into a condition where self-awareness seems to be absent. According to Vedanta, self-awareness is not at all absent. This is where we make a mistake. There is really no unconsciousness. No unconsciousness. If our diagram has been clear to you, this should be also. In that state, consciousness remains the eternal undergirder of all its phases. This turiya is the light that can never go out. Yes, the curtain has fallen in the theater. No more drama today on the stage. But you, the witness, are sitting there in the empty theater, seeing the temporary absence of thoughts, knowledge, mind, ego. And so you suppose I was unconscious. Yes, that which says I, thinks I, was not in play. But what the Upanishads say is that this residual basic consciousness, where mind, intellect, and ego have all disappeared, is the Atman, our true self. Well, what glory is there in that, you say? It is darkness. No one is there. At present, it is darkness to us because ego and all our other personal faculties are in abeyance and will return. They have not been transcended. They bring us once more to dream and to waking and to the fundamental ignorance which shadows our life. The large circle still defines our individuality. Until that line is dissolved, erased through meditation and other spiritual exercises, we shall not be able to experience the witness consciousness as light. Nevertheless, Vedanta assures us that just as a person may walk every day over a buried treasure of gold and not know it, so do we enter into the embrace of the supernal light, and through our ignorance, we call it dreamless sleep. Now a final point, Turiya, the fourth, the consciousness which transcends, underlies, and permeates the three phases of our day and night, can be looked at from the limited standpoint of one or more of those states. We can also understand a little how it must look to itself. No small circles, no margins, no limitations, no shadows or superimpositions. To itself, it is all-pervading, always without ignorance, the essence of freedom. It is, in fact, not different from Brahman, the ultimate reality. A summary. We took up the controversial, some may call it the delicate, subject of consciousness, and we have put out, in clear terms, as clear as we can, exactly how it is regarded in the tradition of the Vedas. As ultimate, primeval, ineluctable, unchanging, infinite, undivided, full of light and bliss. Vedanta boldly declares that this is non-different from the Godhead and inseparable from us through every moment of our existence. We began by distinguishing what consciousness is not. Then we proceeded to analyze its unvarying presence in and under the superimpositions of body and mind, and by this means to get us to arrive at an intellectual grasp of the matter at least, if not a breakthrough into experiencing it as it truly is. Through devoted meditation and persistent discrimination, we make that glimpse a firm and permanent experience.